Well, welcome to the Days of Unleavened Bread 2022 edition. Does it sometimes feel to you, as it does to some, that by the time you actually sit in the Holy Convocation part of this first annual Holy Day of the festival year, it's as if you've already been doing this for a while now? If so, I know from more than a few church member conversations that you are not alone. For one thing, if you actually like matzos and other unleavened bread possibilities, and if before today, the 15th day of the first month of the sacred year, if you jumped the gun just a little bit and have actually already enjoyed some unleavened favorites, guilty, then you may already be in the groove of unleavened products. I think we've already consumed 2 boxes of matzos at our house. It's not fair. We saw them like a month ago and said, "Oh, matzo, we better get some now, just in case." 5 days later, they were gone. I've discovered that matzos go very well with one of those basic food groups called peanut butter. And they just don't last long around the house for some reason. But beyond that physical explanation, why does it seem that we've already settled into the pattern for some time now? Partly, I think, it's just the nature of God's observances. Once they begin, they go very swiftly. And we already were making announcements about the last day of Unleavened Bread coming up this coming Friday. But I also think it has to do with the dual-track meaning of the observance. What do I mean by that? Why does God ask us to do the things that He does in this and many other matters? What's the importance, for example, of setting aside leavened products for a week? What's the importance of that? Because it's a very physical thing, it does make a difference. You do have to be on guard. We've probably all had the experience of discovering some leavened product or some leavening agent that could be used to make a leavened product on our premises during the Days of Unleavened Bread, or in some ways worse, after they're over. Because then you don't even have the satisfaction of throwing them out. What difference is it going to make then? You had it through the whole week. You still can learn lessons, of course, but we've probably all been there. But that's not the only thing. We had a very pleasant evening last night. We were invited to join some others in a meal at a local restaurant in a very private room. I didn't even realize how many private rooms this place had. We had a very, very nice small room totally to ourselves. And one of the ladies brought in a little tray of matzos, and we specified don't bring any crackers with the cheese tray and, you know, the usual stipulations. And I'm sure that the staff there were aware that there must be something unusual about the event. So one of the questions that was asked when the waiter or waitress came to take our order, the first thing she said was, well, one of them, she said, "Now, I realize this is a special celebration. Can you eat meat tonight?" And everybody, "Oh, yeah, we can eat meat. And bring on the meat." So, "Oh, okay, well, then let me just tell you some of our specials. We have calamari. We have blue crab cakes. We have, you know, all the special, I mean, all the appetizers basically have unclean stuff in them." So, somebody spoke up and said, "We're not into that kind of stuff." So, so we got down to business pretty quickly, and it went very well after that. But, so what is this deal? What's the deal with the no pork or shellfish thing ever? Why does God say that? And that other thing about what we earn from our jobs is not ours just to do with as we please. What's with that? The first 10% is God's. The second 10% is ours, but with restricted use. And don't forget the needs of those less fortunate than yourself, the needy among you. All of that is to come from our income. What's with that? Well, there's actually a verse that's sort of peripheral to something I want to read later on today, and I don't think I actually got to it this morning in Youngstown, but there's a verse in Deuteronomy that points out that it says, "He is the one who gives you the capability to acquire wealth." It may be our income, but who had to give you the skills, or the strong back, or the good mind, or the opportunities, or the educational potential to lead up to it? I can list a whole bunch of things. Where did all of that come from? And that's something to remember. Does anything else like that come to your mind? Because I think today is a good time, as we have now begun the annual festivals again, to explore an important principle that shows up in virtually everything God instructs us to do in our service to Him. Good time of the year is to begin that lesson. What is that? And why is that? And where does it leave us as we move through our physical lives, which move rather quickly, as we've discovered, those of us who have lived through a good chunk of them? And what happens after that? How do we reconcile those things if we look at others who may be what we would certainly describe as good people, good folks, but who don't think that the things you and I do are all that necessary, like the tithing or the pork or shellfish, you know, abstaining from, or the annual holy days, or for that matter, the weekly Sabbath? What about that? There may be other questions we could ask, but that ought to at least get us started. So if you'd turn with me to Exodus chapter 12, we'll begin today. You know that Exodus 12 is the description of the first Passover, and the first mention of any of the annual festivals in God's Word. There are a lot of details given early on in the chapter about the exact procedure to be followed. I won't follow through with that part now because that isn't the type of Passover we now keep, as you all know. Jesus Christ left us an example through teaching his disciples just the night before he was betrayed, arrested, and murdered the next day to show them how it should be done going forward, the New Testament Passover. But there's still some important principles to learn from the date, the name, and lessons that even were learned back then as we move forward to today. So pick it up in Exodus 12 and beginning in verse 25. He says, "You shall observe this thing as an ordinance for you and your sons forever," verse 24, "and it will come to pass when you come to the land which the Lord will give you, just as he promised, that you shall keep this service. And it shall be when your children say to you, 'What do you mean by this service?' that you shall say, 'It is the Passover sacrifice of the Lord.'" Now there's a bit of a double entendre in there, isn't there? It's the Passover sacrifice of the Lord. But who was the Lord that we're talking about? Who was the one that we believe was the God of the Old Testament, the pre-incarnate Jesus Christ, right? So the Passover sacrifice of the Lord has a double meaning. Because he would become the Lamb of God. He would be the Passover sacrifice in the New Testament. But at any rate, it says, "You shall say, 'It is the Passover sacrifice of the Eternal, who passed over the houses of the children of Israel in Egypt, when he struck the Egyptians and delivered our household.' So the people bowed their heads and worshipped. Then the children of Israel went away and did so, just as the Lord had commanded Moses and Aaron, so they did." This is where we'll start today. Let's pick these verses apart through here and other places in Exodus and Deuteronomy and figure something out. Why was this so important? Clearly obvious to us, I would think, it was to save their lives. At least the lives of all of those who were firstborn. Just out of curiosity, how many of you here today are firstborns in your family? I am one. I'll put my hand up. We've got a few around the room. Do you feel threatened? Not now. What if you had lived back then? What if you had lived back then? Can you put yourself in their sandals 3,500 years ago or so? What was God's purpose in requiring this odd action on their part? The details of the Old Testament Passover, separating the lamb, killing it between the evenings as the 14th began, attaching the blood to the doorposts of their home and the lintels of the doorways as a sign that here were God's people. His people Israel lived in this dwelling. The death angel, we were told, would pass by or pass over them and not take the life of any of the firstborn in that dwelling. Well, in verse 13, right here in this same chapter of Exodus 12, it spells it right out for us. It says, "Now the blood shall be a sign for you on the houses where you are. And when I see the blood, I will pass over you, and the plague shall not be on you to destroy you when I strike the land of Egypt." It was to save their lives. That's a pretty important premise to work from. I have a question. Is it possible that obedience to any and all of God's commands and instructions for us is really that basic? Is it possible it's really that basic to save our lives? And if it is, how can the annual lessons embedded in the Passover and the days of unleavened bread get us started on the right foot each year in what is actually our ongoing obedience to what God's purpose is for creating humans in the first place? That's the guts of the question for today in the sermon. So let's start with the Passover, which we already did this past Thursday evening, a little less than 48 hours ago now. We've just finished looking at some of the first instructions given in Exodus 12, although we didn't go into a lot of detail for the exact procedure for the Old Testament Passover. And we've seen something more than a little unusual here that I just kind of read over and didn't stress, and that was in verse 28. It says, "Then the children of Israel went away and did so. Just as the Lord had commanded Moses and Aaron, so they did." How often do you find those words in the books of Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy? Not frequently. Why? Because the threat was obvious to them. It was to save their lives, protect their family units. And they could see a direct connection. They were still in slavery. It would be the results of the Passover night that would provide the impetus and the springboard for them to be released. And even then, as we know, they would be pursued, but God would still protect them. So there's something so special. There was another such incident a bit later on of the obedience of the Israelites. It's in chapters, well, let's look at Exodus 35. Let's go there for now. The first few verses of Exodus 35 talk about clarity on the Sabbath and how important it was to keep it. We'll pick it up in verse 4. Exodus 35, verse 4, "And Moses spoke to all the congregation of the children of Israel, saying, This is the thing which the Lord commanded, saying, Take from among you an offering to the Eternal. Whoever is of a willing heart, let him bring it as an offering to the Eternal." There's a colon there, and it begins to list in incredible amount of detail the various offerings that were needed for work on the construction of the tabernacle. That's what this is about. The details that would be needed to construct the tabernacle in the wilderness. You go through and see all that was needed, and then you begin to see the planning. And in verse 20, It says, so all the congregation of the children of Israel departed from the presence of Moses. And then everyone came whose heart was stirred, verse 21. And everyone whose spirit was willing. And they brought the Lord's offering for the work of the tabernacle of meeting, for all of its service, and for the holy garments. That would be for the priests, of course. They came, both men and women, as many as had a willing heart. And they brought earrings and nose rings and necklaces and all jewelry of gold, that is, every man who made an offering of gold to the Eternal. And every man with whom was found blue, purple, and scarlet thread, fine linen and goat's hair, red skins of rams and badger skins, brought them. And everyone who offered an offering of silver or bronze brought the Lord's offering. And everyone with whom was found acacia wood for any work of the service brought it. All the women who were gifted artisans spun yarn with their hands. I suspect we've got quite a few that would answer to that description in this room. And they brought what they had spun of blue and purple and scarlet and fine linen. And all the women whose hearts stirred with wisdom spun yarn of goat's hair. The rulers brought onyx stones and the stones to be set in the ephod and in the breastplate and spices and oil for the light, for the anointing oil, for the sweet incense. The children of Israel brought a freewill offering to the Lord, all the men and women whose hearts were willing to bring material for all kinds of work, which the Eternal, by the hand of Moses, had commanded to be done. And Moses said to the children of Israel, see, the Lord has called by name Bezalel, the son of Uri, the son of Hur, of the tribe of Judah. You probably recall the name Hur. Remember that it was Aaron and Hur who held up the arms of Moses while he was praying during the battle with the Amalekites, right after they came out of Egypt. So this man, his grandson, Bezalel, had to have been fairly young, because Hur was appeared to have been of the same generation with probably with Joshua, or maybe a little bit younger than, maybe a little bit older, I should say, than, say, Joshua, but certainly up in the leadership of the people at that time. And he has filled him, Bezalel, with the Spirit of God, in wisdom and understanding, in knowledge and all manner of workmanship, to design artistic works, to work in gold and silver and bronze, in cutting jewels for setting, in carving wood, and to work in all manner of artistic workmanship. And he has put in his heart the ability to teach in him and Aholiab, the son of Ahisamach of the tribe of Dan. He has filled them with skill to do all manner of work of the engraver and the designer and the tapestry maker in blue, purple, and scarlet thread, fine linen, and of the weaver, those who do every work and those who design artistic works. This was going to be quite the production, quite the proposed product and job that had to be carried out. It's as if God said, all right, I've appointed the foreman on the job site. I want them to be Bezalel and Aholiab. They will be in charge. And that's how it's going to work. Look at all that happened here. This whole section is the beginning of another opportunity for a lesson that I'd like to focus on today. The instruction given to Israel to begin to gather the materials to build the tabernacle in the wilderness where God would dwell, so that they could visibly see that his presence was known to be with them. Now, why was that so important? Well, we'll get to that in a moment. But look at what happened, this outpouring of generosity. You notice, too, that in verses 30 to 35, there is an additional oomph given by God through utilizing the power of his Spirit. It doesn't necessarily say these men were converted, but it says that they were empowered by his Spirit in these specific ways. And look at as we go on into chapter 36. Here's what began to come together. And Bezalel and Aholiab and every gifted artisan in whom the Lord has put wisdom and understanding, we've already seen several references to indicate this was men and women, to know how to do all manner of work for the service of the sanctuary, shall do according to all that the Lord has commanded. Then Moses called Bezalel and Aholiab, and every gifted artisan in whose heart the Lord had put wisdom, everyone whose heart was stirred. We saw that reference in verse 27 or 26 with the women who were stirred with wisdom. And every gifted artisan in whose heart the Lord had put wisdom, everyone whose heart was stirred to come and do the work. And they received from Moses all the offering which the children of Israel had brought for the work of the service of making the sanctuary. So they continued bringing to him freewill offerings every morning. It just keeps pouring in. Then all the craftsmen who were doing all the work of the sanctuary came, each from the work he was doing. So they each had an assigned duty and they could tell what they needed. And they spoke to Moses saying, "The people bring much more than enough for the service of the work which the Lord commanded us to do." So Moses gave a commandment, and they caused it to be proclaimed throughout the camp, saying, "Let neither man nor woman do any more work for the offering of the sanctuary." And the people were restrained from bringing, for the material they had was sufficient for all the work to be done. Indeed, too much. That's kind of a heartwarming example, isn't it? Especially when we know all too often the disappointments we feel as we read through the example and the history of ancient Israel. Now, as you go further, I'm not going to go into detail, but the nation was really into this, you can see, really into it. And they had to be told to stop. Stop already, it's enough. The gifted artisans got to work, all of them, men, women, whoever had these gifts and abilities began to go to work. You can see a whole lot of the details beginning in this chapter 36 and all the way through chapter 37, 38, and a major part, almost all of chapter 39. And it is a lot of detail. In fact, there have been various ones who've done studies and tried to research the details to try to come up with an approximation or a general idea of what this must have looked like back at the time it was constructed. You can probably find that, you know, Google has everything, you know. I'm sure you can find it somewhere if you look it up, the various models that have been created even to show what the tabernacle in the wilderness may have appeared to be like. It's pretty astonishing. What should all this detail tell us? Well, for one thing, the importance of carefully obeying God's instructions in every last particular. That's what it ought to tell us. You know, what if, for example, we had the idea and we decided, what if we were to think, you know, I just don't see the point of doing it this way. Why wouldn't this other approach be okay with God? You know, somebody tried that approach a very long time ago. You know what his name was? Cain. How did that work out for him? How did that work out for his brother Abel? Because when you get to down to it, the key hint and the problem of this approach is the phrase, "I just don't see the point." And not to put too fine a point on it, or to be mean, I would say, so what? The point is, what does God say? What does God see? What does God require? What does he lay out? That's what's important. My opinion, your opinion, any human opinion, of what value is it compared to God's? And that's where, in so many cases, the human race has gone off track. What happened back then with all this generosity? It was another amazing demonstration, one of the few in their history of careful and detailed obedience by the Israelites. Turn to chapter 39, Exodus 39. It talks about how this was all being put together. It says in verse 32, "All the work of the tabernacle of the tent of meeting was finished. And the children of Israel did according to all that the Lord had commanded Moses. So they did." They brought the tabernacle to Moses, the tent, all its furnishings, all the materials. They set it up. They get it ready. The garments of the ministry or for the service of the Levites are there. Verse 41, the holy garments for Aaron the priest, his son's garments. And then verses 42 and 43 echo verse 32. According to all that the Lord had commanded Moses, so the children of Israel did all the work. Then Moses looked over all the work, and indeed they had done it, as the Lord had commanded, just so they had done it. And Moses blessed them. I like that phrase, just so they had done it. That's one of the few times in their history that there could be such a wholehearted, well done, given to them. And it was all set up just the way God had instructed Moses to do it. Now, there is something interesting. Doesn't all this tell you something? Does it tell us about ourselves? Anything about you or me in these more modern times? One more thing we should probably take note of. Did you catch the timing of these chapters in Exodus? From 35 through 39. What well-known event had just happened a few chapters prior to this spasm of generosity? Turn back to Exodus 31. Now, Moses, you understand, in chapter 31, is up on the mountain talking to God. When the cat's away, the mice will play. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, verse 1 of chapter 31, saying, "See, I have called by name Bezalel, the son of Uri, the son of Hur, of the tribe of Judah." Does that sound familiar? "And I have filled him with the Spirit of God in wisdom, in understanding, in knowledge, and in all manner of workmanship, to design artistic works, to work in gold, silver, bronze, in cutting jewels, for setting, in carving wood, to work in all manner of workmanship. And I have appointed with him Aholiab, the son of Ahisamach, of the tribe of Dan. And I have put wisdom in the hearts of all the gifted artisans, all of them, that they may make all that I have commanded you." And he begins to list the tabernacle of meeting, the ark of the testimony, the mercy seat, the furniture, the table, the utensils, the gold lampstand, on and on and on and on it goes. All of this detail was being given to Moses by God while he was on the mountain with him. We know that he was absent nearly 6 weeks. Chapter 24 and verse 18 says that he was gone 40 days and 40 nights. Almost 6 weeks, 2 days short of 6 weeks. What happened to the Israelites during the time he was gone? Chapter 32. When the people saw that Moses delayed coming down from the mountain, the people gathered together to Aaron and said to him, "Come, make us gods that shall go before us." We have to see our gods. Well, not really. Not if you have especially God's Spirit working with you, which they did not. But it is interesting that what was God's proposal, even before they rebelled? His proposal was to make a place visibly present with them where he could be seen to be dwelling. The presence of the cloud by day, the pillar of fire by night, over the tabernacle of meeting in the wilderness. But they couldn't wait. They couldn't wait for Moses to come back. He's been gone so long. "As for this Moses, the man who brought us up out of the land of Egypt," that's a pretty remarkable man to have that power, "we do not know what has become of him." And Aaron, in one of his moments of great weakness, a righteous man we find in other sections of the Bible, but in one of his moments of weakness, as he admitted to his brother later, he feared the people. And he gave in to what they asked. And they made this monstrosity of a golden calf to worship. We know Aaron's explanation to Moses was very similar to most people's excuse-making mechanisms today. He said, "You know the people. I thought they were ready to stone me. So I told them, bring me gold, and I threw it in the fire, and his calf walked out. What was I supposed to do?" Well, that's not quite what it says, but it's pretty close. Pretty close. So God intervened. But this had just happened just a few chapters before we got into chapter 35. And maybe they were also thinking, we need to obey carefully to save our lives. There were 3,000 people who died, it says, over the worship of this golden calf, executed by some of the priesthood tribe of Levi, who acted for God according to what he said to do. All this is so interesting. Moses was actually away from the people, in God's presence, getting the exact details of how to construct the tabernacle, even to being given the names of the foreman of the project, Bezalel and Aholiab. All of that's being poured out to him, all this detail. He's getting it all noted down carefully. I'm sure God helped him to remember. And while he was away, the golden calf. Terrible choice. Terrible choice. And so was the punishment. 3,000 dead, probably more affected. The next time, and there was a next time, things went much better. Moses was away for another 40 days and nights, according to chapter 34 and verse 28. Another 40 days and nights. And this time, the Israelites behaved themselves. And a special sign drove it home. If you look at Exodus 34, God tells Moses to write the words. And it says in verse 28 of chapter 34, "So he was there with the Lord 40 days and 40 nights. He neither ate bread nor drank water, and he wrote," God wrote, the capital He, "on the tablets," the ones that Moses replaced, the ones he'd shattered, "the words of the covenant, the Ten Commandments." Those are the words that support and are behind and are the base of the covenant, any covenant God makes with humans. "Now it was so when Moses came down from Mount Sinai and the two tablets of the testimony in his hand that Moses didn't know that the skin of his face shone while he talked with him. So when Aaron and all the children of Israel saw Moses, behold, the skin of his face shone, and they were afraid to come near him. Then Moses called to them, and Aaron and all the rulers of the congregation returned to him, and Moses talked with him. Afterward, all the children of Israel came near. He gave them as commandments all the Lord had spoken with him on Mount Sinai. And when he'd finished speaking with him, he put a veil on his face. Whenever he went in to speak to God or with God in the tabernacle, he would take the veil off." Well, when he would speak with God, the tabernacle was not yet constructed. Whatever he did this, he came out, he would come out and speak to the children of Israel whatever he'd been commanded. And when they saw his face, that his skin shone, Moses would put the veil on his face again until he went in to speak with him. And as long as that condition continued, I imagine it gradually faded. But it was a visible sign. The Israelites needed a visible sign. They were a culture, the pagan cultures around them were cultures of visualization, of imagery, golden calves, and other types of depictions of gods. The God that they were to worship was giving Moses things to write down. To write down. His word has some abstract concepts in it you can't very easily depict with a visual image. It's kind of interesting, isn't it? How would you characterize our current culture now? Is it a culture of visual imagery, or is it a culture of learning and studying words? That's not even a question, is it? It's a no-brainer. Well, there are so many things to learn from all this. We're learning and moving to some key lessons in our own lives, aren't we? Should be. I want to today with some that can be helpful as we begin the Days of Unleavened Bread for 2022. So let's first look at a couple of lessons we can draw from Israel's physical experiences. First one, physical actions that are commanded by God are to teach us spiritual lessons. I know that's basic. Physical actions that are commanded by God are to teach us spiritual lessons. even in ancient Israel, without access to his spirit by the vast majority, with a possible exception, well, certainly of Moses, Aaron, and a handful, Joshua, God still ached for his people to be disobedient all the time. Turn to Deuteronomy, which, as you know, is sort of a summary and a repetition of all that had happened that Moses reiterated and reprised with the people before his own death. Deuteronomy chapter 5. Deuteronomy 5 and verse 1, "And Moses called all Israel and said to them, Hear, O Israel, the statutes and judgments which I speak in your hearing today, that you may learn them and be careful to observe them. The Lord our God made a covenant with us in Horeb. He did not make this covenant with our fathers, but with us who are here today, all of us who are alive. The Lord talked with you face to face on the mountain from the midst of the fire. I stood between him and you at that time to declare to you the word of the Eternal, for you were afraid because of the fire and you did not go up on the mountain." He said, and then he reiterates the Ten Commandments here. Pretty much almost a word-for-word recitation from Exodus 20. Same law, clearly. And then you pick it up in verse 22. The story continues. "These words the Lord spoke to all your assembly in the mountain from the midst of the fire, the cloud, the thick darkness, with a loud voice. And he added no more. And he wrote them on two tablets of stone and gave them to me." Then he reiterates again, tells them again what they did at that time and how he responded. And then drop down to verse 28. "Then the Lord heard the voice of your words when you spoke to me, and the Lord said to me, I have heard the voice of the words of this people which they've spoken to you. They are right in all that they have spoken." And then look at the next words. Basically, he says, they're talking the right talk. And then he says, "Oh, that they had such a heart in them, that they would fear me and always keep all my commandments, that it might be well with them and their children forever." What's the point of doing exactly what God says? That it might be well with them and their children forever. Then it's as if he has a bit of an aside to Moses, what we'd call a sidebar, an editorial. "Go and say to them, return to your tents. As for you, stand here by me, and I'll speak to you all the commandments, statutes, and judgments which you will teach them, that they may observe them in the land which I'm giving them to possess." And then Moses resumes speaking to the people God's words. "Therefore you shall be careful to do as the Lord your God has commanded you. You shall not turn aside to the right hand or to the left. You shall walk in all the ways which the Lord your God has commanded you, that you may live, and that it may be well with you, and that you may prolong your days in the land which you shall possess." What does he want for his people? He wants us to learn, and he wanted them to learn. He wished, he said, "Oh, that there were such a heart in them." That's the reason for the physical actions he commands, to teach spiritual lessons. You remember all the detail that we saw referenced? I didn't actually read through it with you, but I pointed to it in Exodus 36, 7, 8, 9. I didn't read through it because the sheer amount of the physical details can be overwhelming for us now, with no real ability to connect it to distinct actions that we need to carry out at this time. But that wasn't true for the Israelites. They needed to do these things. Every single step had a purpose. And it was a detail of a larger whole. The tabernacle, although physical, it was really just a tent. In fact, it was called the tent of meeting in one verse we just read. Was a vehicle for testing their obedience. In practical fact, everything God told them and the miracles he supplied were all with the same intent, testing their obedience. Turn to Deuteronomy chapter 8. Deuteronomy 8, verse 1, "Every commandment which I command you today, you must be careful to observe, every one, that you may live and multiply and go in and possess the land of which the Lord swore to your fathers. And you shall remember that the Lord your God led you all the way these 40 years in the wilderness to humble you and to test you, to know what was in your heart, whether you would keep his commandments or not. So he humbled you, he allowed you to hunger, he fed you with manna, which you didn't know, nor did your fathers know, that he might make you know that man shall not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds from the mouth of the Lord. You know who spoke those words in the New Testament. To Satan, who was trying to tempt Jesus Christ. Your garments did not wear out on you, nor did your foot swell these 40 years. Almost 3 years ago, my wife and I went on a 10-day tour of Israel, the FI project or proposal there, the FI trip that we made. And everybody's feet swelled in Israel for 10 days. I mean, you're walking those dusty lands and you get back to the hotel and you say, whoa, what happened there? I didn't think I had two watermelons with me when I left, but you know. So you lay down, you put your feet up, and you try to ice them, and the next day they swell again. And finally recovered after we got back for a while. But after having been there and just 10 days walked the land, this was a miracle. Your feet didn't swell for 40 years? It's pretty astonishing. You should know in your heart that as a man chastens his son, so the Lord your God chastens you, or guides you, or disciplines you. Therefore, you shall keep the commandments of the Lord your God to walk in his ways and to fear him, but for a good purpose. Verse 10, it says, when you've eaten and are full, then you will bless the Lord your God for the good land he's given you. Beware that you don't forget him by not keeping his commandments, his judgments, his statutes that I command you today. Lest when you've eaten and are full and have built beautiful houses and dwell in them, and when your herds and your flocks multiply, your silver and your gold are increased or multiplied, all that you have is multiplied, when your heart is lifted up and you forget the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt from the house of bondage, who led you through that great and terrible wilderness in which there were fiery serpents and scorpions and thirsty land with no water, who brought water out of a flinty rock. He fed you in the wilderness with manna your fathers didn't know. Why? That he might humble you and that he might test you to do you good in the end. That's what it was about. Then he says, you'll say in your heart, my power and the might of my hand have gained me this wealth. This is my money. And you'll remember the Lord your God, for it is he who gives you power to get wealth, that he may establish his covenant, which he swore to your fathers as it is this day. What's the purpose? You know, Paul used the analogy actually of a tent. We've talked about the tabernacle or tent of meeting. Remember? He used that analogy for our physical lives in his second letter to the Corinthians, 2 Corinthians 5, first four verses. The knowledge that everything God instructed them was really a way of measuring their obedience, and the reason it was so important to obey him leads to the next point. Second thing to think about. The reason God gives us any of his instructions is for our good. For our good. We saw it in Deuteronomy chapter 6. If you've read that recently, if you haven't, I suggest you do. It begins by, this is the commandment, these are the statutes, verse 2, that you may fear the Lord your God to keep his statutes and his commandments, that your days may be prolonged. Hear, O Israel, verse 3, be careful to observe it, that it may be well with you, and that you may multiply greatly. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Famous passage. In Jewish tradition, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, your soul, your strength. And these words which I command you today shall be in your heart. You'll teach them diligently to your children and talk of them when you sit in your house, when you walk by the way, when you lie down, when you rise up. Bind them as a sign on your hand, a frontlet between your eyes. Write them on the doorposts of your house and your gates. Verse 18. He says, "And he shall do what is, you shall do what is right and good in the sight of the Eternal, in the sight of the Lord, that it may be well with you, that you may go in and possess the good land which he swore to your fathers." And verse 20, "When your son asks you in time to come, saying, 'What's the meaning of the testimonies, the statutes, the judgments which the Lord our God has commanded you?' Then you shall say to your son, 'We were slaves of Pharaoh in Egypt. And the Lord brought us out of Egypt with a mighty hand, and he showed signs and wonders before our eyes, great and severe, against Egypt, Pharaoh, and all his household. And he brought us out from there to bring us in and give the land of which he swore to our fathers. He commanded us to observe all these statutes, to fear him for our good always, that he would preserve us alive as it is this day.'" That's what's important in God's eyes. We just read much of Deuteronomy 8 and we saw the same point. You want a practical and interesting Bible study approach? Perhaps during the days of unleavened bread? Go through the entire book of Deuteronomy. That's a summary of, I didn't say do the whole Pentateuch, just Deuteronomy, and look for how much stress you find on that very point. That whatever God asks of us is for our good. See how many times you find that. And see what it tells you. That central lesson hardly stopped with ancient Israel. At its core, it's a spiritual lesson. David clearly understood it, even as he began recording the book of Psalms. In the very first psalm, just six short verses, listen to what sets the tone for the book of Psalms. "Blessed is the man who walks not in the counsel of the ungodly," Psalm 1:1, "nor stands in the path of sinners, nor sits in the seat of the scornful. His delight is in the law of the Lord, and in his law he meditates day and night. He'll be like a tree planted by the rivers of water that brings forth fruit in season, whose leaf will not wither, and whatever he does will prosper." Isn't that really a same theme being expressed in slightly different words? "The ungodly are not like that. They're like the chaff which the wind drives away. Therefore, the ungodly won't stand in the judgment, nor sinners in the congregation of the righteous. For the Lord knows the way of the righteous, but the way of the ungodly will perish." There's a difference in God's eyes. And there's a difference in the lives of those who obey or those who choose to rebel. From those two points, and some of the material we've covered from ancient Israel's experience, pose a question to yourself here. Ask yourself a question. Is the focus of the Old Testament only on the physical? Is the focus of the Old Testament only on the physical? I think the answer has become rather obvious to us, hasn't it? Which really explains why Paul stressed when he wrote to the Corinthians in 1 Corinthians 10, something we've read many times. 1 Corinthians 10, verses 11 and 12. Familiar words. "Now all these things happened to them as examples. And they were written for our admonition, upon whom the ends of the ages have come. Therefore, let him who thinks he stands take heed lest he fall." Let's shift our focus a little bit. We ask the question, is the focus in the Old Testament only on the physical? How about a companion question? Is the focus in the New Testament only on the spiritual? Somehow I have a feeling you're probably ahead of me on this. You probably know the answer already. So let's list a third lesson for today and see where it takes us. This one's a little longer, but a third lesson from the first day of unleavened bread, and especially Israel's experience. Any attempts to spiritualize away key points of God's instruction often leads to disobeying God completely and missing both the letter and the spirit of the law. Any attempts to spiritualize away key points of God's instruction often leads to disobeying God completely, which would mean we would miss both the letter and the spirit of the law. How many people would tell you that, well, you don't have to actually put out leaven for a whole week? I mean, it's just that was just, they did that back in ancient Israel, and it was kind of a strange custom. You don't have to do that. You want an apple fritter? Go eat an apple fritter. Do I want an apple fritter? Yeah, but I'll wait for a week. I'll survive. You're a French toast kind of person. You can survive. Besides, you ever had French matzos? Never mind. Besides, there are all kinds of clever and innovative recipes you can find, I'm sure, to experiment this time. You know, break out of your shell. Okay, matzos are sort of like shells, but that's beside the point. Which New Testament reference should we read to teach us this lesson I've just stated, that any attempts to spiritualize away God's instruction leads to disobedience? How about the words of God in the flesh in the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew 7? Matthew 7, verse 21, after saying, "By their fruits you shall know them," Jesus is wrapping up the Sermon on the Mount, and in verse 21 he says, "Not everyone who says to me, 'Lord, Lord,' shall enter the kingdom of heaven, but he who does the will of my Father in heaven." It's a pretty strong statement, but he's about to get even stronger. What exactly do you think he meant by this? Well, he explains in the next few verses. Verse 22, "Many will say to me in that day," now look at this explanation of actions, "Lord, Lord, haven't we prophesied in your name, preached, cast out demons in your name?" Well, I don't know about that, but what if it could be done? "And done many wonders in your name." We're told in prophecy that one of the determining signs of the man of sin to be revealed, according to Thessalonians, is that he will be able to work miracles, but not by God's power. Miracles are not the sign of where God is working. They can reinforce it, but you have to go by what Jesus tells us here. "Then I will declare to them, I never knew you. Depart from me, you who practice lawlessness." What does 1 John 3:4 say about lawlessness? It's a definition. It says sin is lawlessness. Sin is breaking God's law, not obeying his instructions. And Jesus' answer to some who came to him and listed all kinds of spiritual sounding duties and things they'd done, his answer is, "I don't know who you are. I'm sorry. You who work and practice lawlessness, leave. Get out of my sight. Until you such time as you can see and repent and come back," perhaps would be the last part of it. That's a shocking statement. It must have been shocking to them because they thought they had it all figured out. Christ's answer echoed an important and ancient principle that God gave clear back in the life of the prophet and judge Samuel. The setting was the prophet's addressing King Saul and his response in 1 Samuel 15 when he'd been given some instructions. He was to deal with the nation of Amalek, the Amalekites who had betrayed and treacherously attacked Israel when they came out of Egypt when they were just fleeing from one oppressor. And so Saul was deputized by God and told to take care of this. Not in a way we would perhaps understand in this culture and time and age, but that's what God said. And he comes back saying he's done what God said. Samuel says, "Wait a minute. You are supposed to eliminate even the animals. What is this lowing of the oxen in my ears?" He tells him, "When you were little in your own eyes, weren't you head of the tribes of Israel?" Verse 17, 1 Samuel 15. "The Lord sent you on a mission and said, 'Go and utterly destroy the sinners, the Amalekites, and fight against them until they're consumed.'" The margin says exterminated. That's very tough language. Only the one who authors human life has the ability and the authority to say when it should be taken and when he will choose to work with them in the second resurrection. That's not for us to question. "Why then," verse 19, "did you not obey the voice of the Lord? Why did you swoop down on the spoil or the plunder and do evil in God's eyes?" Saul said to Samuel, "But I have obeyed the voice of the Lord. It wasn't obvious to him that he hadn't. And I've gone on the mission which the Lord sent me, and I brought back Agag, the king of Amalek, and I've utterly destroyed the Amalekites. And apparently he didn't see the irony there. They're all gone. Well, except this one here. But the people took of the plunder, the sheep and the oxen, the best of the things which should have been utterly destroyed. You're right, Samuel. We should have done that. But the people did it. And, here's a good one. They did it to sacrifice to the Lord your God in Gilgal. That sounds good, doesn't it? We'll sacrifice them to God. What did Samuel say? Has the Lord as great delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as in obeying the voice of the Lord? Behold, to obey is better than sacrifice, to heed than the fat of rams. For rebellion is as the sin of witchcraft or divination. And stubbornness is as iniquity and idolatry. Because you have rejected the word of the Lord, he has rejected you from being king. Saul reached out to grab hold of Samuel's coat to say, please don't turn away from him. And he tore part of it off. And Samuel took the opportunity to say, you see what just happened to my garment? That's what God's going to do with you and tear away the kingdom from you to your neighbor who is better qualified than you. King David. While it had the concept of sacrificial offerings as its point of departure, wasn't it in fact a spiritual principle being stated here? Samuel says, is God after sacrifices? What does he want? To obey his voice. That's a spiritual principle. Timeless wisdom. Several points. Clear instructions were given. Same thing as in the New Testament. We can substantiate the keeping of God's annual holy days by the New Testament church, Jews and Gentiles alike. They all were taught to keep God's holy days. Human nature, as in Saul's case, convinces itself that it has obeyed. It's awfully easy to be guilty of self-deception. Could you or I do that? Of course we could. The response, I had a more spiritual idea. Let's sacrifice the animals. That's what we'll do. We'll bring them back and sacrifice them. God said, that's not what I told you to do. You really think sacrificed animals is what I'm all about? That's not the point. God has the only true answer and the response. If you simply obey my instructions, you will understand my purpose. Saul had a very foggy and fuzzy idea of what God wanted because he disobeyed. What's the psalm that says, a good understanding have all those who do his commandments? Obedience comes first. So let me ask a question about this premise where we are here today. What is this all about, this incident with Samuel and Saul and so on? Is it physical or is it spiritual? The answer, yes. Yes. Let me illustrate this reverse application that sometimes shows up in New Testament times in the lives of the Israel of God. That's from Galatians 6:16. Can you describe the sense of accomplishment you have in preparing for the days of unleavened bread at the moment you have removed the last of the leavening from your house, from your car, from your office, forever you are responsible for, whatever areas are yours? Is that sensation primarily physical or spiritual? Do you see my point? I can't speak for you, but I can try to describe my own experience because it happens every year. Of course it's physical on one level. After all, it usually involves a fair amount of physical action. In my case this year, I thought I'd help in, you know, pulling out the stove and cleaning it, and there's the fan over top, and for some reason it has a sharp pointed metal edge, and I need to start wearing those bicycle helmets when I help do things like that around the house. Now, that was physical, but we learn lessons. Trying to vacuum areas of the car that may be hiding crumbs from that fast food sandwich I had back in September, and it ran under my seat. Causes contortions of the body that cause aches and pains until about day 4 of the days of unleavened bread. But I learned lessons. When that last garbage bag is set out, and this year, in a wonderful sense of timing, our trash day was Friday morning. It was perfect. Set it out the last day, because when that doesn't happen, you know what you have to do. You have to get a very dark garbage bag, and you put the last of the leaven in it, and you dress in dark clothes, and you creep around, you drive around searching for a dumpster, and you wait till nobody's there, and then you leap out of your car with the garbage bag, and you run over, and you try to, and it's locked, and you're going, come on, come on. But isn't it quite a sensation when you have the last of the leaven out? I know it's physical, but doesn't it remind you of the whole point of these 7 days? Isn't there some sense of relief? Does that relief have only physical components? I doubt it. In the quintessential New Testament verse about the days of unleavened bread, look at how Paul mixes and matches in 1 Corinthians 5. First Corinthians 5:6, your glorying is not good. Do you not know that a little leaven leavens the whole lump? Therefore purge out the old leaven, that you may be a new lump, since you truly are unleavened. For indeed Christ our Passover was sacrificed for us, therefore let us keep the feast, not with old leaven, nor with the leaven of, what? Apple fritters and donuts? Malice and wickedness, but with the unleavened, bread is implied, of sincerity and truth. These are spiritual qualities, for good or for bad. How is it then that there can be a set of leavened material and a set of unleavened material like this unless spiritual traits are inspired by physical actions? And physical actions focus our minds on spiritual goals. And of course, this was written to a primarily non-Jewish audience. There were Jews in the congregation there, as there probably were in all the congregations Paul served, because there were synagogues in most every city of the ancient world. But that wasn't the primary demographic of the congregation. These were people who did not have a background of familiarity with what they would have thought at one time were Jewish festivals. And yet, this analogy would have no meaning unless they were keeping the days of unleavened bread, would it? It wouldn't make any sense to use it. They were keeping the days of unleavened bread. What about Thursday evening this past week, 2 days ago almost, as you kept the Passover? Did you experience what my wife and I talked about later was so clear to us, a sense of calm and serenity and peace and quiet joy? Was that physical or spiritual? The three symbols of the Passover are physical things: to wash the feet of another, to eat a small piece of unleavened bread, to sip a small amount of red wine. But what's the meaning? What's the sensation? How does it spread? But that clearly identifiable sense of quiet joy and peace has much deeper roots, does it not? Brethren, we are officially launched into the annual pattern of the festivals designed by God, commanded by God, blessed by God. Can you recite from your heart the lessons we are to learn, that we are to experience from all of them, one by one, as we go through the year and keep them all? I bet you could. I bet you could go down the line and explain it all. Can you explain which ones involve a bit more physical effort and planning to be ready for? Of course. But aren't there spiritual lessons to be learned in those, like now? Can you detail the clearer grasp and understanding you're experiencing every year as spiritual overtones and concepts and recollections and prophecies and desperately hoped for and prayed for fulfillments inch ever closer? Is any of that entirely physical? Is any of that entirely spiritual? Or is the answer in the fact that God blends all of it together into one seamless, perfect package, one impossibly beautiful gift for His much-loved children every single year? I'll let you answer that question.